So welcome. So this is session two. I'm glad that not too many were scared off from last week. And I do have some answers for you, too, to share tonight. Are there any new folks here that weren't here last week? Okay. Welcome. Oh, lots of new folks. Okay, good. Well, if you have any questions as we go through, we're going to do a brief review tonight. But if you have questions or you want information about what we covered last week, I'm happy to talk with you after class. We'll talk a little bit about some of the things tonight. Have any of the new folks ever been in a Buddhist center before? None of you. Well, so one. This center? Or okay, so you came here a few times. Okay. All right. Well, kind of maybe. All right. Well, my name's Karen Mastriani, and I'm the facilitator this time. We have several very experienced folks in the class, so we can always ask them questions if I can't answer like we did last week. So feel free to ask. I also took some notes, and I have some answers for everybody as well from some of the things that came up last week. So that was very good as well. And then just for the new folks, the handouts are available on our website under Buddhism in a Nutshell, under that tab, and some of you probably have gotten those already. If you have any questions about those, I did bring those back with me tonight. My email is up here, so feel free to email me even in between sessions if you have questions or you need any information. So tonight, the plans are we're going to do a little bit of a meditation with the intentions like we always do, a brief review from last week. We're going to talk about the history of Buddhism, specifically kind of how it spread from India and the little map of progress that it took to get here to the West. We're going to talk about the mind and the Buddhist view of the mind and philosophy of the mind. We're going to really spend a little more time on the Four Noble Truths, which we introduced last week. It didn't go into a lot of detail about, and a little bit about what it means to be a Buddhist in a little more detail in terms of what is the path and what is it that you know we follow. So, with that being said, how about if we just do a brief meditation, and just for everybody to review, and especially for those who weren't here last week. And if you were here last week and you want to try a cushion, remember, you don't have to, if you're sitting in a chair, you don't have to stay in a chair, come down, get on a cushion for a few minutes, go back to a chair. There's plenty of space, and so you can just kind of play and try different things out. If you're too hot or cold, let me know. Feel free to get up and make yourself some tea or get some water if you'd like. So it's pretty informal. I'm pretty informal. Ask questions, interrupt. Don't hesitate to do that. And so the one thing we talked about last week is the 7-point posture. And first of all, this isn't meant to intimidate or, you know, when I first started meditating, I'd sit down, I'd think, oh my gosh, you know, I couldn't even remember how to sit, let alone start to meditate, and just be comfortable, okay? But there is a reason for the posture, and so I do want to explain that to you so that you know, and we gotta, I don't want to say trick our minds, but we gotta start controlling our minds right from the beginning that we're not sitting down in front of a television, we're not sitting down to eat or to socialize, we're sitting down to meditate for a specific kind of meditation. And so the whole process of preparation starts to, you know, just starts to get your mind ready for that. So, not to intimidate you, we're just letting our minds know we're doing something different. And so the 7-point meditation posture, it's legs, arms, back, eyes, our jaw and mouth, heads, and our tongue. And so we're going to start out by our legs. And so you want to be, sitting comfortably on a cushion. Your hips a little higher than your knees can really help with that posture and stability. You can sit in a full lotus position if you can do it. And if anybody can, I may have you demonstrate it. Are you in a full? Kind of half, but you can do a full. Where both the soles of your feet are, your feet are on your thighs and the soles of your feet are facing you. Most people can do a half. Some can do a whole where, I can do a half. Some can just sit cross-legged. However you can sit is fine. If you're in a chair, you usually want to make it a firm cushion. You want not to be leaning back, slouched. You want to just sit up a little bit, even away from the back of the chair while we meditate. But the real key is uncross legs or feet, and your feet should be firm on the floor. And when I say firm on a floor, a cushion is fine, just so they're not dangling. You want your feet firm. Because you really want in a nice, stable position. Your hands should be loose in your lap. Here, our right hand is on our left palm with our thumbs lightly touching. Not comfortable doing that. Just either rest them in your lap or rest them comfortably on your legs, whichever is comfortable for you. Your arms should be just slightly away from your body to let some air in for ventilation. Nice, relaxed posture. Back should be straight, with your head slightly tilted forward. So as I said last week, if you think of your backs as a stack of coins, and if I was to pull a string from the top of your head, it would just, I should be able just to tug on that stack so that they're nice and straight, but not rigid. Your eyes, it's good not to keep them open, but if you're not comfortable closing them, that's fine. You don't want a lot of distractions that you're looking at. So if you're not comfortable closing your eyes, just look downward in front of you. If you're comfortable closing your eyes, not all the way closed, just let a little bit of light in, so slightly closed or slightly open, however you want to think about that, so that you don't get too drowsy. And then your mouth and your jaws should be relaxed. Your mouth just lips slightly touching. And your tongue should be right behind your top teeth at the roof of your mouth. And then I already said your head just tilted slightly downward. And now after all that, just take a couple of deep breaths so you can just really now begin to relax. And just bring your attention inward. And let go of any stressors from the day. Any of the stresses of getting here. Those who were here for the first time last week know the difficulty and stress and even just trying to get into our parking lot, even if you saw our building. And some of the new folks that came tonight may have had that same struggle. And just recognize any hassles or stresses. And let that go if you can. And we're going to do just a brief body scan. And for the scan, just start and begin wherever your body touches the earth. Could be your feet or your legs or your backside. And feel the weight and substance where your body touches the earth. And pay attention to your mind or your sense of awareness while you're focusing here. And then just gradually move your attention upward. And as you do, notice any sensations that you're experiencing in your body. Don't have to change, don't have to worry or be concerned. Just notice, recognize the sensation. Maybe recognize where you hold some stress or tension. And then just keep gradually moving your attention upward. Focus your attention at your heart. In Tibetan Buddhism, there's not a differentiation between the heart and the mind. And sometimes we say heart-mind. And then gradually move your attention up towards your head, to the crown of your head, relaxing your facial features as you move your attention up. And just notice your mind or your awareness as you focus your attention on the crown of your head. And then just move your attention back down. Slowly move back down, noticing sensations until you reach the point where your body's touching the ground. And again, just notice your mind or your awareness when you're paying attention to where your body touches the ground. And just rest there. And is there a difference in your awareness from where, when you were concentrating at the crown of your head versus the weightiness of where your body touches the ground? Now just set your intentions for being here tonight. It takes great effort to come. After working, whether in the home or outside the home, just to drive and get here, leave the comfort of our houses. And there's a reason you did that. Curiosity. Could be a learning as part of your journey. It could be a real interest or commitment in Buddhism. And recognize that regardless of the reason, we're here for our own well-being, peace of mind, for ourselves, but also knowing that we can improve the well-being of others as well. And then dedicate any positive insight that you learned in doing the scan. And maybe dedicate it for your well-being and the happiness of others and well-being of others. So, did you notice any difference when you were concentrating at the crown of your head versus when you were thinking about your awareness where your body touches the ground? About the same? Some notice? If anybody wants to share, remember, Mr. Microphone, for those who are new, when we ask a question or we make a comment, we will ask that you speak into the microphone. So for the recording or those listening, it's not just this blank pause and they don't have a clue what anybody's saying. Anything? Someday I know Patrick and Chris are going to make sure that there's automatic mics in the room, right? You're not.
Chris can, but I have no comment.
I found it interesting that when I focused on my heart, I could hear it or know it beating more than it's just I'm completely unaware of it otherwise.
That's a good point. So true. Our breathing and our heart rate are, you know, autonomic nervous system. Don't even think about it. Don't even pay attention. And then when you do, it's just really kind of special and you can really appreciate. Thank you. Anybody else? All right. Last week we talked about the importance of setting those intentions and those dedications. And it's just a nice practice to do with anything you do, you know, any work that you're starting, any project, you know, before you make a phone call or talk to somebody, they're just nice practices to do, and it can set your whole frame of mind and even just change your approach to what you're about to do. But especially try to do that practice when you're meditating. Important to do. And realize that it's a practice, right? Some of you may have been meditating for a while, but for many of us, you sit there and all you're thinking about is, I really should be sitting here doing something. I should be sitting here meditating. And it's, you know, you're so distracted by your own thoughts, you can't even get it together. And I've heard Geshe-la say, get up, splash water on your face, walk around the room, come back and sit down. Anything just to try to break those train of thoughts if you can't do it while you're sitting. And then I would keep shortening my meditation. Like I started out very grandiose of 10 or 15 minutes or whatever it was. And then it was 5. Okay, I'll just try for 5. And then it was 2 minutes. And literally after about 2 months of trying to meditate, I went back to 2 minutes a day until I could gradually keep increasing from there. Anything you do, one breath is helpful, right? Did you have any questions or issues? Did any of you try to meditate during the week? Some of you probably have had a practice, so some of you have practiced it. Any issues or anything come up when you were doing that?
Excuse me, sorry.
Last week you mentioned about the counting where we count to 10 with the breaths in and out, and if we lose track of things, we start again. What constitutes losing track, and how many times do you
question.
Have to try again?
Oh, hundreds. I mean, literally. So what constitutes losing track? I guess when you literally don't remember what number you're on. And I used to think, as long as I remembered what number I was on, I'm not losing track. Now I know that's not true. it's amazing how many thoughts I can have while I can sit there going, one, oh, what am I going to do at work today? Two, then I thought, oh, geez, I'm not losing track, and I didn't. So keep counting, but try to recognize that and pull your mind back. So it's not just when you lose track of the counting that you should remember to pull your mind back. You want to catch it when your mind wanders off anytime. But definitely, when you lose count, either guess where you are, because it doesn't matter, or go back to one. And I don't care if you go back to one a dozen times sitting there for 2 minutes or 1 minute. That doesn't matter either. The key is we're catching it. And that's really what the practice is. That's what we want to do. Catch our mind wandering and gently bring it back. And we're going to practice that again tonight. So we'll see how that goes again tonight. We'll practice that in a little bit. Yes. There's two questions, Patrick.
So if you don't lose track of the number that you're on, but your mind does wander, do you still go back to one?
No, I don't.
You don't? Okay.
Maybe it's kind of cheating. I don't think so, because I remember what number I'm on, and at least I noticed that I was distracted. Because sometimes I can sit there for 10 minutes and not even notice I was distracting. So if I can remember it quickly, that's pretty good. I rejoice any time I can catch it. And I just continue counting as long as I didn't lose track.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry. In front of you.
Thank you. I wanted to say one of the problems I had was actually not the thoughts. My imagination would come up with visuals, and I'd have to bypass those.
Minds are tricky,
yes.
Tricky.
But I was practicing earlier this week, and I got to a point around 10 minutes where it felt like peace and bliss, like as if I was surrounded by a mountain or a lake or something. It was a very nice feeling. I was very impressed by it.
And some people are very visual, so that's okay. Yeah. And if you can visualize what that feeling is, as long as it's not an excuse to keep your mind focused on the object. So if your object's not the mountain and the lake, we probably want to bring it back to whatever the object of our focus is. But it's kind of nice just to sit there for a little bit anyhow and appreciate that. And you can ask questions as we go on. So this doesn't have to be the end if you had some other questions. And so a few questions came up last week. And so I do want to answer those before we get to the review. And I just want to also remind you that there's no errors in the teachings. So that if there's an error, I have to correct myself the next week, or I have to go to Geshe-la for correction. It's me as the facilitator. It's not the teachings, because there are no errors in the teachings. But a few of the questions that came up last week, one was about getting the recordings for these sessions. And right now, you do have to be a member to get the recordings. And you know, somebody asked, should they join to get the recordings? And it's probably not a good reason to join. So there's, you know, you want to make sure that this is your commitment to the path. And we will find a way to get you the teachings if we or the recordings. If we can't figure it out, Chris, could they bring a thumb drive and I just pull it off my laptop after the class? If the teaching from the week before or something, we used to be able to do that, right?
Yeah, I can even like burn a CD with all the class recordings on it.
Yeah, either way. So you can just let me know and we'll get you any teachings that you missed that way, even if you can't stream or record it. The other question, I think it was you that asked about why do we always circumambulate clockwise? And John came up with a good reason about rites maybe being more auspicious, and that might not be too far off. I found in the readings that the Buddha circumambulated the Bodhi tree 7 times. Quite interesting, because that's a Jewish tradition as well, that you circumambulate things 7 times. And he circumambulated clockwise when he circumambulated the Bodhi tree. So I asked Geshe-la, I said, this is what I found. What do you think? He said, oh, that's not it. And he said, it's much more complicated than that. And he said he would find a simple way to explain it to us. But he would let me know when he thought of a simple way. He said, otherwise it's just going to be too complicated. And in the scheme of things, probably the simplest thing is for now to know there is an auspicious reason that we do go clockwise. He said it wasn't always like that. You used to go counterclockwise. And he said, and then he tried to explain to me why it changed. And he said he'd find us a different way. And then there was another question or comment about we can't experience everything. I said, examine what you hear. Don't take it at face value. Even when you're reading a teaching of the Buddha, check it against your experience. And somebody said, well, it's not like when we talk about no beginning and no end and the stream of consciousness, it's not like we can experience that. And maybe there's some things we can't experience directly. We just have to check. We have to read. We have to see how things feel with us. And does it seem like a plausible hypothesis or not? If it doesn't, you keep investigating for a while. You just don't believe it because you heard it here. And so then there was something on NPR, like the next day about light years and about a new planet or galaxy or something being found and how many light years away it was, and that if you traveled at the speed of light, how long it would take you to get there, which was like some astronomical amount of time. And I thought, I don't really know what a light year is. I'll never experience that, and I'll never experience the speed of light, but I know it exists, and I believe in climate warning. And if we, warming, and if we had that discussion in here, I would venture that some of you don't. And so we're looking at the same material, but we weigh it against, you know, what we believe and what we don't believe. And so, you know, that's all I ask. Some things we might not experience, but we can still examine it, just like you would if you were buying gold or a diamond. So take it for that. And then there was also some questions and discussion, and that came up again tonight about Buddhism seems so difficult to study, and there's so much to learn and get. And Geshe-la, at last Wednesday's teaching, and some of you were at that teaching, it was just an incredible teaching, and I swear he must have been in our heads last Tuesday, but he said, studying Buddhism is difficult. He was talking about a completely different subject. And he said, it should be. It has to be. We're talking about how to reach enlightenment and achieve liberation. That can't come easy or without effort. And so it is difficult. And then he said, but there's so many simple ways that every day, every minute of the day, that we can gain merit. And he said, it's not complicated at all. And as we all gain merit, whether we're Buddhist or not, we're becoming better people and we're following right along this path. And so he said, think good. So no matter what negative thoughts come in our mind, if we can switch it to think good, and we'll talk about that some more in these next few weeks, and then to rejoice. And he said, not just to rejoice when you do good things or have good merit, but to rejoice when we hear that other people do good things, so that if you read something in a newspaper about something good somebody did, rejoice that they did that good thing, and that when we rejoice in somebody else's good merit, it actually, we gained good merit from that, which I just thought was a beautiful, wonderful thing to say. And he said, when, you know, rejoice in what you do, simple things, picking up litter on the street, you know, anything, rejoice in what you do, moving a stick that's on a sidewalk so somebody else doesn't step on it. And he said, make offerings, which is a simple thing to do. I did it last night. You know, you get in your warm bed, and you just think, I'm so grateful I have this bed. I wish everybody had a warm bed to get into or a warm house to be in. And I rejoice that I have that. When you're standing in a shower, You know, just think about the shower hitting your skin in the warm water, and think about all the people who don't have a warm shower, and rejoice that you have that and wish that they do. You know, when you're hugging somebody you love, or your kids, or, you know, I think about my grandkids, and the first thing I think is, I wish every baby in the world were loved as much as they were. And you just make that wish, and you rejoice that you have these things. And those are the ways that we can all gain merit and do good. It's that simple. You know, it's that simple, and we don't need to make it any more complicated than that. So, I think that was all the questions that everybody had, and now I'm going to make it more complicated again, but but just remember, it started out that simple. So I'll take some deep breaths, and then we'll go on. So, last week, we did talk a lot about meditation, and we're going to talk a little bit more about what is meditation. We talked about the history of the Kadampa Center and our beautiful history. I try to talk some of our board members and our center director and coming in to say hello. They're here for a meeting, and they're like, what are we going to do? Come in and say hello, and then walk back out. We talked about the life of Shakyamuni Buddha, which we'll talk a little bit about. Just barely introduced the Four Noble Truths, and we're going to go into more detail, lots more about suffering. And then we talked a little bit about the purpose of this class, which is really to glaze over these topics in not a whole lot of detail. And last week, you know, we talked about who was our historical Buddha, who was Shakyamuni Buddha, and just a few reminders that he was a man who was born as a prince, Prince Siddhartha. And so he wasn't, you know, this divine supreme being or a creator god. He was a person just like we are, who searched for answers and the meaning of life, spent 6 years searching, and then realized there's a middle way, and so sat under the Bodhi tree for 49 days, just meditating on that meaning of life, and achieved enlightenment in that time, where he eliminated the obscurations, the negativities from his mind, and replaced it with how he came to realize reality and what the true nature of reality is, which he said is what all of us can do. Once he achieved enlightenment, he went on to teach for 40 years after his death. Are you taking care of me, Wendy? Thank you, my dear. I thought, who's coming in that door? And he gave 84 different teachings, 84,000, I'm sorry, different teachings before he died at the age of 80. And that's where he passed into this complete state of liberation from suffering, or Parinirvana. Even though he gave 84,000 teachings, there is no contradictions in any of those teachings. People heard what they needed to hear. The teachings were meaningful to some, and some of the teachings weren't meaningful to others. And it's the same with any of you in here who have been to Geshe-la's teachings. You know, you sit in these teachings, and sometimes I'll go to the same teachings a half dozen times, and every time I walk out, I learn something new. And so it's just like either you're ready for it, or you hear it differently, or somebody says it differently, and so we can always learn. He gave three main teachings, which we call, you know, turning of the Dharma. And the first one was the Four Noble Truths, and that was the first turning of the wheel, which is what we'll talk about some more tonight. We talked a little bit about Dharma, meaning it's protection. It's protection of our mind. We use the term Dharma really to mean the teachings or experiences we have on a more mundane level, but so we use that term in different ways. Any questions or comments on what we talked about last week? Yes. Well, thank you, Patrick.
Thanks. I'm not trying to be irritating, but this is like...
No.
It says he passed into parinirvana, complete liberation from suffering. Is that at the time of death, after death, or...?
Yeah, that's the way I understood it, that he achieved the enlightenment when he was sitting under the Bodhi tree, where he realized, he had these realizations of what reality really was, what the truth was, but I believe he was still in a human body and did suffer, and he died. And it was when after death that he reached that state of parinirvana, where it was complete liberation of all suffering. I can't say that with 100% certainty. Okay. I think that's right.
I'm just like wondering, like, how that's actually verified, or like if it has to be experienced to be understood. And it's, I guess he experiences that after death, but. How do the followers of Buddha, of the Shakyamuni Buddha, know this to be truth, or how does this understood come? I mean,
so how do we know that to be true?
It's a difficult question.
Yeah, that's a good question. I can't say I ever experienced it. I don't know anybody who's ever experienced it. We can talk more about this after class. I'm happy to. So how do we know? I mean, do you have any thoughts about how you know things that you haven't experienced but you know? And with Buddha's teaching, I mean, even though he died, we do know that he came back. You know, the whole goal of liberation is to help other people be liberated. We know that he gave teachings in other places besides just here on earth. No, I can't say we know that. We've been told that. I'll change the way I say things.
Is it because as you're learning or going down the path, you see like glimpses of the truth that are sort of pointing evidence towards this?
Yes, people do. So people do. There are people who have lived since Buddha and before Buddha who have achieved emptiness and who have continued to taught. There are people who I have heard about and some who I have met who know people who have actually experienced the death process just by through meditation and allowing the their conscious mind to do that, and then they come back and they teach on what they saw as they in that transition period before they came back. We know real life stories of people who aren't Buddhists who have done that, who have experienced the death and come back and told us what that felt like. So yes, there are people who have. Does that help? Otherwise, don't take it by my teaching or faith. Do not. Just wait. Just sit with it and see. Read. Read about the story of the Buddha. Read His Holiness's teachings. You can't go wrong with any of the Dalai Lama's teachings and what he says about these things. Make sense?
Yeah, makes more sense.
Yeah.
I think, like, for me, as I start asking questions and thinking about it myself, then things.
Yeah.
The answers for me become more clear of the answers to questions that I'm personally looking for.
Yes. And a lot of times you have to ask those questions, and your questions are never irritating. just because I might not be able to answer them, don't ever think anybody in here is irritating me, and I will get you more information. Yes, ma'am.
What? How dogmatic is Buddhism? But by that I mean, what if you don't believe something? I don't believe in corporeal beings after death. And, you know, if I just don't go for that, does that mean I can't be a Buddhist, or does that mean that I just don't experience that part of something?
Yeah, the lightning bolt's going to come down. I'm ducking. No. Yes.
I'd like her to clarify what she means by corporeal beings, because I think, okay.
Oh, you want me to do that? You know, did Buddha die and he remained Buddha, or did his energy go someplace else and he's never Buddha again? I mean, to me, you know, the energy could come and still be energy because of the Big Bang and all that stuff, but I don't think people stay the same after they die. You know, it's not the same person, it's not the same thinking, it's not a body, it doesn't have the same feelings that a person does that's alive.
Ah, so we are going to talk more about what you're talking about. We are going to talk about what Buddhism, you know, the teaching in Buddhism for rebirth. We'll talk about, is it, when I come back, is it, will I still be Karen and have the same limited knowledge and the same silly jokes? Will I even recognize that that's who I am? And so we are going to talk about that. I also want to say that we call them two wings of a bird. You have, you know, wisdom and compassion. Those are the two, but, you know, what Buddha really realized. Many of you in this room may have the wisdom that I don't. You can't tell by looking at somebody. I certainly don't have the wisdom, her no emptiness or have seen emptiness. I can barely work on compassion. And so those are the two wings that we're always constantly working on. And if we had the wisdom, then we could know all of this and answer each other's questions pretty quickly, right? So when Buddha died, he wasn't a Buddha until he became enlightened. So he was Siddhartha, man. And then he was kind of recognized as a Buddha at some point while he was giving teachings. People really respect him. Probably like Jesus wasn't Christ until 100 years after he died, right? And so, you know, the recognition may or may not come later, but we're going to talk about emptiness and what does being a Buddha mean, and what does, you know, what does our own self mean, and how those change, you know, throughout our lives, after we die. And so we will talk about some of that. Maybe that'll answer your question. And if it doesn't, after we talk about this, then ask again. Does that help you at all? Scott used to teach Buddhism in a nutshell.
Probably not as well as you do, but I heard something, I think maybe it was Venerable Amy that said this, one of the teachers that comes here sometimes, and I think it was really helpful, kind of, and addresses both comments that you guys are making, but it may have been her, maybe wrong about that, but whoever it was said something like, if you listen to what some of the, you know, you read the teachings or you listen to teachers, and the easier things that they say make sense, that's kind of helpful, you know, if you hear someone giving a teaching on compassion or you read some of the Buddha's teachings on things like, you know, things that you can relate to in your everyday experience. And that kind of allows you to maybe be a little more confident in what they're saying about the more complex things that you can't. And at least take those things as a hypothesis. I mean, that's another thing that we said. I know a lot of teachers have said, even, you know, the Buddha himself said, don't believe anything that I'm saying just because I'm saying it. You have to take it all as a hypothesis and just accept it at that and not like an instant answer to these huge questions we can barely wrap our mind around. So that was just helpful for me.
That's very helpful. And we talked about that last week, right? Take this as a hypothesis. Leave what you don't understand on a shelf. Thanks, Scott. And I think the other thing along the same lines, I don't know who said that, and I don't remember hearing that, but that's helpful. And then the other thing I heard is, does it make you feel better? And if it doesn't make you feel better or it doesn't feel good, and you probably need to put it aside or not think about that right now or let it go. Or if it's like me, you probably were thinking about it the wrong way and maybe you just need to go ahead and reorient, and because you should feel good. You should have a peaceful mind. You should be a happier person as you're, you know, following and learning and practicing. Doesn't mean we're not a little frustrated and we don't have all the answers, but we shouldn't feel bad. Thank you. I thought about that when you were talking, which was kind of similar, and that helped me when somebody said that. All right. But again, ask more questions as they come to you. So we are going to talk about a little bit about how Buddhism spread and what some of the Buddhist traditions are. And it, you know, it started 25,000 years ago, which we talked about last week. And it spread gradually, you know, mostly starting in India, and then it began to spread outward from there, going from India to Sri Lanka to Asia, specifically Southern Asia, and then it went to Southeast Asia, China, and Japan. It didn't get to Tibet until the 7th or 8th century, which is quite later than where it, you know, when it was in the other areas of Asia. And, you know, it was a similar process. Either, you know, people heard about different teachings or a teacher came to that area and spread the word there. And in each country that Buddhism moved to, it, you know, the culture, the time that it got there, the different beliefs of the time, it was influenced by all of that. So in every area, it's just looks a little bit different, and a different tradition. And the traditions, you know, and when Scott taught this too, we never used PowerPoint. And some of the other teachers in the past year or so started using PowerPoint. I thought, I don't know if I'm going to like it. And then I thought, I'm going to like it tonight. That way I don't have to be spelling these words. I'd pull in a whiteboard and I'd be spelling things. And so this will be helpful. And the other thing I do want to just say again from last week is, you know, as Buddhism spread, or these earlier traditions, remember, it was a completely oral transmission of the teaching. And the cool thing is when you receive a teaching here at the center, they can, you know, whoever is teaching it can tell you the lineage of that teaching, because you want to keep that lineage. And so when Geshe Law is doing a teaching, or Geshe Law's teacher comes and does a teaching, and he'll say, and that was taught by this person, and they can track it all the way back in time to the person who gave the first teaching. So it's an unbelievable transmission of that whole lineage. The oral transmissions and the memorizations remain strong. I said that last week. You know, they really do a lot of memorizing. But even us in the Western practice of Buddhism, like, we'll memorize prayers or chants, and that way you don't always have to have a book and paper in front of you. You can do it from memory. So the oral tradition really does continue in whatever tradition of Buddhism that you're in or that you're following. So I did just want to mention that. And so I'm going to tell you a few of the Buddhist traditions, and they all end in jhana. And it really just means, you know, a vehicle. And Lama Yeshe said that, you know, when you go on a long trip, you get in a vehicle, and that gets you there, you know, whatever the best way is. You know, you find the right vehicle, be it a train, car, boat, plane, so that you get there the best way. And he said the same. Said that a lot. Same here, I guess. I had never heard him teach. And there's three main traditions or jhanas. One of the oldest ones is the Theravada tradition, also known as the Hinayana tradition, and some of you had practiced and studied Theravadan Buddhism. It's a southern tradition, sometimes called the lesser vehicle or the individual vehicle. It relies on the Pali language, and it spread from India to Sri Lanka to Southeast Asia. It still remains very strong today in those areas. And it really emphasizes, hey, Wendy.
Theravada means tradition of the elders. Theras are monks who have been ordained for 10 years or more. So Vada means a tradition. So the Theravada is a tradition of the elder monks.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, it's tradition of elders. Thank you. And it really relies on meditation, concentration, and the whole idea is individual nirvana, individual liberation. That's the primary focus of the meditations. So you want to free yourself from suffering. And it's similar to the Zen tradition, which is about trying, you know, you reach that individual nirvana or liberation. The other jnana is the Mahayana tradition, which is the tradition of the Kadampa Center here and what we follow. And this is considered the universal vehicle or the greater vehicle. It's a northern tradition. It's recorded in Sanskrit, spread to China, Tibet, Korea, and Vietnam. And this tradition, it's individual liberation, yes, but it's to reach enlightenment to help all. So the primary focus isn't on our own liberation, but on achieving our liberation so that we can help others become free from suffering. So that's the primary motive. So there's love and compassion in all the traditions, including the Theravadan tradition. It's not like one is better than the other. It's just where is the primary focus. And then the last one, which is within the Mahayana tradition, and I'll just mention it quickly, but it's the Vajrayana. And it's the vehicle that's considered kind of a quick lightning bolt way to enlightenment, and it's a lot of ritual, it's a lot of, you know, higher practices, a lot of great yogis practice this, where you're using, you know, you kind of see yourself as a deity, and it's a whole practice around that. And that's the rituals and through meditation is where that is achieved. And then I already said that, you know, there's differences within the traditions as well. Like, you know, has anybody been in a Zen center? It's very stark, it's white, there's not a lot of color, you know, you're really focusing inward on individual self. In Tibetan Buddhism, lots of colors, prayer flags, you know, it's a very colorful place. Scott, I think you're the one that explained to me, you know, in Tibet, there's not a lot of flowers or color. It's a pretty cold, sparse country. And so they like to add color to things. And that kind of stuck with me and always made sense. So one's not necessarily better than the other. Probably the Vajrayana is the exception. So you have these different vehicles or different jnanas, and then you have schools within the Mahayana tradition. And I'm not going to say a lot about these. We're the Gulags, you know, we're within the Gulag tradition. That's what His Holiness the Dalai Lama follows. There's not a lot of differences with these different schools. There's some different beliefs. I know that I've been at teachings with His Holiness, and you know, the spiritual leaders within the Nyingma tradition were there on the stage next to him, you know, sitting, you know, right there, leading the teaching. So there's less and less differences, and there's really more unity between these four schools than anywhere, you know, than anything. So they're more alike than not. So you have the Golub tradition, the Nyingma, the Kagyu, and the Sakya traditions within that. Any questions, comments? And that's about all we're going to talk about, the vehicles and the different schools. But it's good to know. If for no other reason, if you hear them, you would think, oh, yeah. And at least you know which one you're studying when you're here at our center. Makes sense? That's really the only reason. There's lots of other reasons to know those. But for now, those are the main reasons to know. And so with the many different traditions, it suits our different dispositions and inclinations. And so then you can try different ones and see which fits yours as well. The essences are the same, and it's not so much to think about these as labeling. Even His Holiness says not to label as Buddhist versus Christian versus the different types of Christianity. I mean, you know, it's a lot of the problems and issues we're having in the world. So this isn't about labeling. It's just about what's best suited for our minds and helps us the best. And then we'll talk a little bit more about what does it even mean to be a Buddhist, and we'll talk about that a little bit more tonight just in terms of the path that we select. But just remember that a Buddhist is someone who is looking inward, looking inward for their own happiness as well as their suffering, and realizing that it's not just external to us, but it's internal, and getting to know our minds. I was listening to, I think it was a TED Talk several months ago, and, you know, he said at 5 years old, kids know the importance of brushing their teeth. And they would never not brush their teeth twice a day. Do you remember who it was that was saying that? Did you hear that too? It was so good. And he was going through this whole list of things that we learn as children are important, but yet we never learn about how to examine our minds or that importance. You heard it. You know, who was it? Oh, Mike. Thank you.
He was a psychologist from Britain, and he was talking about mental health and how how is in terms of physical health, we have all these habits that we would never not do because that's what we do to maintain it. And he thinks in the future, mental health will start to move in that same direction in terms of we will have habits that we will build within ourselves and just create in our schedules because that's what we need to do to have mental health and probably kind of like this.
That was it. Thank you. Yeah. So just fascinating. And that really is where we have to go, right? And where we are going from the Googles and everybody else who is, you know, bringing this to mainstream to make a big difference. And that's really for our own happiness and well-being. It can't just be about the physical or basic. For those of you who have kids, we have wonderful books out there in the bookstore that can just even help a kid to begin to grasp that going inward and thinking and mental health. So we're going to do another meditation here in a minute. And we talked about what was meditation last week, and we talked about that, you know, it's becoming familiar with our mind. It's that moving inward. And in Tibet, the word is gom, and gom means to become familiar, and we're becoming familiar with our mind. We talked about becoming familiar with our mind as well as virtuous states of mind, and we'll talk about what are virtuous states versus, you know, negative or non-virtuous states of mind. And there's two types of meditation. We've been just doing focus or concentration meditation, and, you know, we'll do a little bit of analytical meditation in the next upcoming weeks where you just focus on a topic and either go deeper about that topic or try to get a better understanding of what that topic is. And focus or concentration is you're focusing or trying to control your mind by focusing on an object. And we have been, you know, either using our body sensations or the breath, which we'll continue to do. And before we talk about what is the mind or what are we becoming familiar with, let's go ahead and get comfortable. I keep getting this cramp in my foot, so you're going to see me moving around a lot. I'll try not to do it while I'm meditating. And I would encourage you, if you feel a cramp or anything, you shouldn't feel pain. So you should move a little bit. So go ahead and get comfortable. Remember, legs, arms, head, tongue. Main thing is feet flat on the floor or comfortable on a cushion. Back nice and straight. And just take a couple of deep breaths. And we're going to practice the exercise of just trying to notice when our mind veers off from our object of concentration or focus, to gently, kindly, and with compassion just pull it back to the object, which for this time it's going to be our breath. And we're going to count from 1 to 10, each exhale and inhale being 1, and then counting up to 10, and then count down from 9 to 0. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the sensation of the breath. So we're all going to count differently. And when you become distracted, you hear a noise that distracts you or a thought, just let the thought float by. If you realize you followed a thought or a story, gently pull your mind back as soon as you notice you've been distracted. If you never make it to the number 10, that's perfectly fine. If you never make it from 9 back down to 1, nobody's keeping score. It's not about reaching a number. It's about the practice of catching our mind when it wanders and bringing it back to the focus of the breath. And when you reach 10, again, just begin counting from 9 to 1. Whenever you get back down to 1, you can either stop counting Or just count back up to 10 again. And regardless of what number you're at, just bring your attention to the sensation of your breathing. And you can either bring it at the tip of your nose where the air goes in and out as you inhale and exhale. Noticing the coolness of the air as it goes in. Maybe it tickles your nose. As you exhale, is the air warmer? What other sensations do you notice? Or you can pay attention to the rise and fall of your abdomen, just like the waves of the ocean. Just pick one or the other and notice. And concentrate on whichever sensation you're paying attention to. Concentrate as if it's the most important thing you needed to learn about right now. I always thought that if I counted backwards, that would make me really concentrate and I would have to really focus. That doesn't work so much. But you keep playing, you know, you keep playing with things and just keep really making your mind focus on the counting or the sensation or whatever you're trying to focus on. And it does get easier, may even be getting easier for some of you now. And so in Discovering Buddhism, I mentioned that on Monday nights, you spend like 5 or 6 weeks talking about the mind. So we're going to spend about 2 minutes on talking about what is mind. And what is mind when you hear that, when you hear somebody say, we're focusing on the mind or changing our mind to virtuous thoughts from non-virtuous. How would you define mind? Any thoughts? You can just holler out, and I'll say them. What is mind?
The field in which consciousness occurs.
Where consciousness occurs. Any other words you would use? People could say consciousness. Awareness is another word that you often hear when you're talking about mind, that conscious awareness or knowing, the mind knows. In Tibetan Buddhism, it's talked about that luminous, clear spaciousness, that knowing conscious mind. It is formless. It doesn't have a form, color, description. And it is awareness. So it perceives objects. Sometimes people associate it with the brain, and there's definitely a relationship there, right? But the brain is a form. It does have color. It does have shape. And, you know, the mind does not. So you know right there that there's a difference between the two. And people will often say the two qualities, that clearness and awareness, that luminous mind, and its function is to know, is another way to describe it. We'll do a meditation. Hopefully we'll have time in the next few weeks on the mind is like the sky, which can be a nice meditation to do. But oftentimes you hear that analogy. It's compared to a clear, calm sky or a calm lake before, you know, all the mud gets stirred around in there. And it's different than the thoughts and emotions that occur. Those are almost like the clouds that go by on the sky, you know, in the sky. And the important concept in Buddhism is that the mind is continually changing, and that it can change, and we can actually change it. So it's viewed as different levels of mind, and there's at least three levels, but the main levels are you have this growth level of mind, which is where we usually are for most of our waking and probably sleeping hours. And then you have a subtle level of mind, which is that clear knowing mind. And the Buddha says that clear luminous mind, that knowing mind is really our true nature. You know, that is really what we're trying to reach when we're practicing meditation and we're trying to meditate. That's the mind we want to know. The growth level of mind is the mind that's taking in all the information externally, right? So you have your senses. You hear, you see, you smell, you taste, you touch, and then, you know, the mental awareness is the sixth kind of aspect of that. We call them senses. In Buddhist psychology, they're considered different consciousness. You know, you have eye consciousness, and you have your ear consciousness and your smell consciousness, etc. And there's lots of studies, lots of research on and teachings on these different levels of consciousness and when we take in information. And then as soon as you see, hear, touch something, immediately, without us even knowing, you know, the thinking and the emotions follow. So we smell something and we think, ooh, you know, that really smelled bad, or ah, you know, I like that, or, you know, a color and that's a nice color, or I don't like that color, and it's just almost immediate as we take things into our senses. And then we just keep piling on more stories on top of stories, you know, as we, you know, as soon as we perceive something with our senses. And that's kind of just a little overview of the gross mind, and then being able to just to clear that away and settle it down to get at that more subtle levels of mind or awareness or consciousness in those streams. Make sense at all? Had you heard some of that before? I know some of you had, because you've taken classes before. And then, you know, we talked about meditation, and meditation is getting at that clear sense of knowing. And part of that subtle mind and is to really learn more about Buddhism, have an understanding of what the meanings of sufferings are, what time is it? Okay, we still have a little bit more time. And we talked about the Four Noble Truths last week. And we talked about it in terms of a physician. And if you think about what the Four Noble Truths are, and the first one is the truth of suffering, the second is the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the last one is the truth of the path to the cessation of suffering. And we'll talk about each of these separately, but if you remember the physician analogy, like the first step is to know we are suffering. We're going to talk about what the different levels of sufferings are. But just to know you are, and that you know, when you're not feeling well, first to realize that, and then to go for a diagnosis. And you go to the healthcare provider that can give you that diagnosis, and then can hopefully diagnose you and then treat the symptoms that you're having, because we want to find an end to that suffering, right? So they give us a prescription or a treatment to follow, but it won't do us any good if we don't follow it. So once we have that prescription, or in Buddhism's case, that teaching, then we have to kind of follow it and practice it in order to alleviate our sufferings. And that's just kind of a nice analogy to see these. And so the first noble truth is the truth of suffering, and that suffering exists. And we see it in our own lives, either in, I complained about a cramp in my foot a second ago, but you know, we have discomfort, we have different complications, we have diseases, we get old, we get sick. And then in Buddhism, we would count death, rebirth, and karma as part of that suffering. And so there are three types of suffering, and the first is the suffering of suffering, which is what all of us would recognize as the discomforts we have and the sicknesses that we have, all the traumas of life. The second one is the suffering of change, which we can also all recognize as well pretty easily. You know, we think of things as permanent, fixed, and unchanging. When we're happy, we expect it to last. But it doesn't, right? And you can just think about it in your own lives, even just sitting here. You sit in a comfortable position, and you're perfectly comfortable. And then you start squirming. Now I'm comfortable. And then you have to squirm again. Or we walked in this room, and it was really cold in here. And so, you know, Chris turned up the heat, and then it's too hot. So you're, at first it's that feeling of, this feels great. And then you have to turn the heat down because now you're too hot. So it's constantly changing, constantly adjusting. Nothing lasts. Even when you buy that brand new car that you think you have to have, as soon as you buy it and drive it off the lot and it gets dinged by a stone, or, somebody scratches it, or I don't know how much it depreciates as soon as you drive it off, but you just think you have to have it. It's going to make you happy. And then pretty soon you realize, oh, no, that wasn't what I needed. Instead, I need, I didn't bring my iPhone with me. I need the newest iPhone. Once I have the newest iPhone, that'll make me happy. And then that lasts just what? Probably not even a few hours. And you can't figure out how to use it, or you lose something, or a new one comes out as soon as you buy that one. And we're just always constantly searching, and even when we know it might not last. Including even with relationships that we have. You know, there's good days and there's bad days, and relationships end all the time, so we can see kind of the suffering of change throughout our lives. And then the last one, it's a little harder to grasp. It's the all-pervasive suffering, or compounded suffering. And this is just because of our karma, our delusional minds, that we're kind of stuck in this cyclic existence, that until we can cut through, break the delusions, get rid of all of our negative karma, and really only practice, virtuous merit, we're going to keep coming back into this same samsaric cycle that we're in of suffering. And that's more of the all-pervasive suffering that most of us don't even see the suffering of change until we really think about it. And the all-pervasive suffering is even more subtle than that. It's much more harder. And so, you see people who are very wealthy, who have all the money, beautiful home, 5 cars in the garage, all their, everybody else's kids are perfect but mine, and they're all with, academically gifted. I couldn't think of that word, but mine, But so we see them and we think, well, they're not suffering. They got it all. Yet they are. It's not lasting. It's not enough for them. They're going to lose it. And if they don't lose it, we're all going to get old, get sick, and die. So, the suffering is for all of us. And it's not, when times are good or we're not feeling a whole lot of discomfort, sometimes we forget that. And the key is just to realize and really think about, that existence and what that means and what is suffering, etc. But you don't just have to think about suffering. We know that there's a way out. And it's really that, that it has a cause. If we can look at what the causes are, we can end it. We can change. That's how we can begin to change our mind. And in Buddhism, we have what are called 6 root afflictions. And it's ignorance, anger, attachment, pride, doubt, and wrong view. And we're just going to quickly talk about these. We'll talk about them again later. And if we don't have time to get through them all tonight, we'll have time next week to talk and catch up so that we're not late leaving here. So these are the 6 afflictions are considered, the disturbing emotions or the negative thoughts in our mind. And the first one, which is considered really the root of all suffering, is ignorance. And it's not, ignorance that we don't know enough. This is a different type of ignorance of the fundamental delusion of how things exist. We look and we see a reality, which of course is just our own reality, and our own story, and we really think it's real and this is how things are and exist. And we're going to talk about this again. It's either the 4th class or the 5th class. It's later on, just that fundamental delusion of how we see reality. And there's 2 different types. It's, delusions, and it's based on on karma as well. And then you have the affliction of anger, which is never helpful, and it's really never, ever good. This is the suffering that really, the affliction that gets most of us, maybe not all of us in this room, so maybe some of you are a little better at dealing with anger. But anger, sometimes we use the term aversion. It's when, you don't like what's out there and we get upset. And usually they say anger happens when we don't get what we want. We may lash out at somebody else. We may think that it's external to us, but it never really is. And it's always harmful to ourselves, regardless of who you're showing anger at. And, I heard His Holiness say once, and Geshe-la has said it several times, that anger is like taking a poison, like you're so upset that you drink a poison hoping that the other person gets sick and dies, and it's really you that it harms. And with anger, we exaggerate the negative qualities of whatever it is, the object. I mean, sometimes it's the computer, right, where, you're screaming at a computer or an inanimate object as if it knows what you're saying. And then, but sometimes it's towards a person, probably more often towards a person. But we exaggerate all the negative qualities in that person or that object, and wish it harm, or we actually want to avoid ever seeing the person again or ever having to use the object again. And it only sees that negative quality, right? You know, once you're focused on that. And then attachment's always a nice, juicy topic to get into, and most of us see attachment as good. You know, when we have nice things, we like having those. We don't see anything wrong with that. When we're in great relationships or we have good friends, we see it as a good thing. And for the most part, it is, except when we get so attached and when we don't get what we want or... excuse me, something goes wrong. So it's not enjoyment that's a problem. We should enjoy things. We should enjoy, you know, the company of people that we like, or, you know, what did you describe, the mountain or the lake, or, you know, like, you know, you're enjoying a beautiful scenery or good food. The problem is what happens when we don't get what we want or something goes wrong in that relationship, etc. And then how do we react? So Venerable Rabina, who's another one of our teachers who comes here at the center, and she's a, have any of you heard of Venerable Rabina yet? So you've been to her teachings, obviously, to react like that. You haven't? Oh, John has told you. She's coming in 20... Oh, did you watch her documentary, Chasing Buddha? Yeah, that's a good... That's good. She's coming this year. I should know when, but I don't. So just March. Thank you, John. March. Oh, my. So a few months. It's a real treat. Come. If you can come, watch our website, come to her teaching. She's Australian. She's like this fireball of unbelievable energy and just gives really incredible teachings. I don't know what she's teaching on in March. It doesn't matter. Even if you know what she's teaching on, then she'll teach on what she wants to teach on anyhow, so the topic won't matter. But she described it once as, it's okay to love chocolate cake, and it's okay to really enjoy, oh, that's a good analogy for the suffering of change, too. It's okay to really enjoy that chocolate cake, but what happens when you don't get it? What happens if you order chocolate cake at a restaurant, and you're just waiting for that chocolate cake, and you see the picture of it, and you're salivating just at the thought of it, and the waitress comes, and she puts down carrot cake in front of you? Do you say, oh, well, I want a chocolate cake, but I'll eat carrot cake? Or do you think, you know, you have to watch her, oh, my gosh, I can't even imitate her. I want a chocolate cake. You know, where is my chocolate cake? And how dare you not give me chocolate cake? And then you make this big scene because you didn't get what you want, which is what most of us do, right? So we over-exaggerate that good quality of that chocolate cake or our girlfriend or our boyfriend or whatever it might be, even our kids. And then when they don't do what we want, how do we react to that? So it's over exaggerating the good. And it's that attachment that, you know, we only want the good things, and we're, you know, we don't quite accept the bad things when they happen in life. And then we'll stop there at attachment. And then we'll finish up the noble truth, and that's really what what we were going to end with. So let me quickly just go and make sure. Nope, I was just going to tell you about what we were going to do next week, which will be finish the noble truth. We're going to talk about samsara and rebirth, so don't miss that one, and karma, and then the 10 non-virtuous actions. And just remember, you can go to our website and you can pull off the handouts. You can join our email as well. And, you know, just remember that all of this is done on a Donna basis. We're volunteers. We don't ask for any payment for any teachings, anything you ever come to at the center. We just ask for you to give from your heart with what you can and the value that you get from here. Like, I just think, what is the value of a Starbucks and what do I get more value from? You know, buying a book here, coming to a teaching, and, you know, can I give that money here instead? So just think about that. You know, pay back for everybody that created, you know, the conditions that we have this center here, and pay it forward, that it never goes away. Because if we don't fund it and this goes away, that'll be it for the next generations. And so in my heart, I want my grandkids and their kids to come and know this center is here. I'll leave you with a little bit of Buddhist humor, and then just be careful going home. Take a second just in your own mind to dedicate any learning, any positive feelings that you got either through the meditations, whatever it is, dedicate that to your own well-being and the well-being of others, and then we'll be getting into really good, juicy topics next week. So I shall see you then.